Good morning and welcome to the Board of Supervisors this morning. If you would all please rise and join me in the flag salute. Are there any additions or corrections to the agenda this morning?
You have no changes to today's agenda.
Hallelujah.
That's because there's hardly any agenda. May we have a motion on the presentation calendar?
Second.
Roll call, please.
Mr. Ashajian?
Aye.
Mr. Linthal?
Aye.
Mr. Ovid?
Aye.
Mr. Patterson?
Aye.
Mrs. Bianchi?
Yes. Mr. Linthal, if you would read the first resolution, please.
Yes, it's my pleasure. Someone been retired from law enforcement and has seen firsthand experience about the sexual assault and the problems we have with violence in this county, to read this following resolution. Whereas sexual assault is an intolerable violent crime with public health implications for every person in San Luis Obispo County as a victim, survivor, or a family member, or even significant other, neighbor, or coworker of a victim survivor, and whereas the Sexual Assault Recovery and Prevention Center has led the way in San Luis Obispo County in addressing sexual assault by providing 24-hour hotline services to victims, survivors, and their significant others, and by responding to emergency calls, offering support and comfort to those impacted by sexual assault during medical exams, criminal proceedings, and empowering those impacted by sexual assault to chart their own course for hearing. And whereas staff and volunteers of sexual assault programs in San Luis Obispo County work year-round to encourage every person in the county to speak out against sexual violence and to support survivors by providing prevention, education, and survivor empowerment information to schools, churches, civic organizations, as well as medical, mental health, law enforcement, education, and criminal justice personnel regarding sexual assault issues. And whereas Sexual Assault Recovery and Prevention Center requests public support and assistance as it continues its efforts to bring real hope for freeing San Luis Obispo County from the tragedy of sexual violence to create a future where all women, men, and children can live free from violence and exploitation. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the Board of Supervisors does hereby proclaim the month of April 2005 as Sexual Assault Awareness Month and April 23rd, 2005, as Walk a Mile in Her Shoes Day. We urge everyone to join the Men's March on April 23rd, 2005, to stop sexual assault and help communicate the message that there is something everyone can do to stop sexual violence.
There's a name at the bottom of there. Of the. You come to the mic.
Jeremy Adams, I'm sorry.
Get to shake all our hands.
Thank you.
And you can say a few words. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Jenny Adams. I'm the Executive Director of the Sexual Assault Recovery and Prevention Center. My staff is passing out pins, teal-colored pins, which is the national color for Sexual Assault Awareness Month. And I just had a couple words. First of all, thank you very much for this proclamation. Sexual assault is a difficult and uncomfortable subject to address, but it is imperative that we do. According to national statistics, 1 in 3 women and 1 in 11 men will be sexually assaulted in their lifetime. This means that in San Luis Obispo County, over 42,000 women and over 11,000 men will be victims of this crime. Last year, there were 118 sexual assaults reported to law enforcement in San Luis County. But according to national statistics, only 11% of rapes are reported to police. This means that there were approximately 630 assaults that were not reported. Sexual Assault Awareness Month is an opportunity to talk about the reasons why rape is so underreported and what can be done about it. This month is about honoring survivors, whether they have told their story or not. It's about raising awareness and destroying myths that make it difficult for survivors and their significant others to talk about their experiences. It's about inviting everyone to join in the effort to end what the American Medical Association has called the silent, violent epidemic. So what can you do? You can become a volunteer, you can make a donation to our agency, or you can participate in discussions with your friends and family. You can also participate in one of the many events that we have happening this month. I'd like to mention two. Please join us on Friday, April 22nd for two showings of SARP Night at the Movies featuring the new film Millions. Tickets include appetizers, dessert, champagne, door prizes, and an all-around enjoyable evening. Then the next day, you can attend our third annual Walk a Mile in Her Shoes event, which will take place on Saturday the 23rd at Mitchell Park. This is the men's march to stop rape, but all are invited to attend and walk. Registration begins at 10:30 with the one-mile walk through downtown. The $20 registration fee includes a picnic lunch and five raffle tickets. High heel shoes are recommended for men and will be provided if needed, although not totally necessary, but it's fun to watch. Finally, I would like to thank the staff, volunteers, and board of directors at the center for the incredible work that they do every day to end sexual violence in San Luis Obispo. They are a wonderful group of people that are absolutely dedicated to the work that they do. Thank you again for your time and attention.
Thank you very much. Our next resolution, if Wendy Most would come to the podium. It gives me great pleasure to read the resolution proclaiming April 7th, 2005 as CASA Child Advocate Day in San Luis Obispo County. The following resolution is hereby offered and read. Whereas the County of San Luis Obispo prides itself on giving back to the community, contributing to the quality of life among our citizens, and whereas CASA Court-Appointed Special Advocates, in association with the National Court-Appointed Special Advocate, CASA Association, speaks for the best interests of the 400 abused and neglected children who are involved in the juvenile courts in San Luis Obispo County. And whereas this effort will give abused and neglected children in our community and around the country a chance for a safe and positive future. Now, therefore, be it resolved and ordered that the Board of Supervisors does hereby proclaim April 7th, 2005 as CASA Child Advocate Day in this county, and in doing so, urge all citizens to join in a national effort to raise awareness and help prevent child abuse and neglect.
We can pause for you. Hold on. We can pause. No rush.
All right. There we go.
We have all day.
Thank you very much.
Mandy Goldman, Papa Bart here.
That's it.
Thank you very much for the proclamation. I would also like to take this opportunity to thank the 108 volunteers and the staff that advocated for 419 children last year. Their incredible service to the county, to the court, and of course to our most vulnerable children is really much appreciated. The SARP Center is a nonprofit that we absolutely support. They're able to help children. They're able to help people 12 years old and older with the sexual abuse that that occurs. However, they have no mandate to help the children. children under 12, and that's where CASA steps in. The statistics that she said were for the adults in our community. However, those statistics do not include the many, many children that we, for whom we advocate, that also have been sexually abused. We appreciate the support of the community to help us raise the money we need to provide a CASA advocate for every child under the court's jurisdiction. I have a note from the judge, the Honorable Teresa Estrada Mullaney, that I want to read to you. I know that if they had the resources, CASA would provide a volunteer for every family in juvenile court. The reality is that in this age of limited resources, CASA is stretched thin, and we are. I am honored to have the opportunity to work with the outstanding CASA program in San Luis Obispo. Their service to the court and the children is invaluable. I have standing with me someone that probably most of you recognize. She was on the front page of the Tribune about a month and a half ago, Christine Cornejo, our board member and CASA supporter, and she would like to say a few words.
First of all, thank you very much. You know, they say there's a Chinese proverb that says that a child's life is like a piece of paper on which every single person leaves a mark. Foster children start off with many, 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 many negative marks. And it's so important. CASA provides such a wonderful thing in these child's lives to have somebody who's stable that they can relate to and go to and know that that person's going to be there from one day to the next because their lives are in such turmoil that they really don't know. And so to have one person that you can go to, they can go to and tell them their wishes and desires and what they want to happen, because they really don't have a voice in the court. CASA acts as that voice and make sure that all their needs are met, and they are very, very important. So by providing that, CASA balances those negative marks by putting some positive marks on these child's pieces of paper and makes their life much nicer. So thank you on behalf of CASA and the board of directors and the staff. Thank you very much. And the volunteers.
And thank you for all of your work.
Thank you.
Okay, Supervisor Rashadjian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It gives me great pleasure to honor the young children we have with us today, and also with us Betsy McDonald. If you want to bring the children up front so we can see them on TV as well. And I believe we have Cal Poly students with us here as well. Would you please come forward too? Why don't you come stand in front of us here?
Here you go. Come on.
Yeah. You know, ma'am, more fun just bringing them behind us. Yeah. They're going to be the future sitting up here. Might as well give them some training early on. While they're coming up, allow me to read this proclamation. This resolution proclaiming April 2005 as Month of the Child. Children's opportunities, our responsibilities in San Luis Obispo County. Whereas Saturday, April 9, 2005, will commemorate the 27th annual Day of the Child. Celebration during Children's Day in the San Luis Obispo Mission Plaza, a day where children and families interact with the agencies and programs providing services throughout the county. And whereas, here, why don't you come forward? Stand by me.
Yeah, they're all here.
Whereas the Week of the Child is a time to recognize that children's opportunities are our responsibilities and to recommit ourselves to ensuring that each and every child experiences the type of early environment at home, at childcare, at school, and in the community that will promote their early learning. And whereas quality childcare is no longer a fringe benefit but a necessity for working parents to be productive and happy employees. Local employers need to be champions in supporting the many challenges facing these working parents and families. And whereas, all citizens are encouraged to develop, to assess, the assess, let me repeat that. See, it happens to grown-ups too. Whereas all citizens are encouraged to develop the assets in children and to do what they can at work, at home, and within the community to help young people make positive choices to avoid high-risk behaviors. And may we remember to listen to and watch the children around us and remember to have patience and allow them to enjoy the journey of childhood. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the Board of Supervisors does hereby proclaim April 2005 as the Month of the Child and April 9, 2005 as Day of the Child. Congratulations, young ladies and gentlemen. you want to say a word, you're welcome to this.
Oh, sure.
You
want to
shake everybody's hand?
And Martine's got ripped, but he was going to give one. Martine?
That's okay.
There you
that's
go.
Good. Thank you very
and
much.
And Daniela? Thank you. Okay, come on.
Elizabeth?
Thank you.
Thanks, huh?
Oh, you're welcome. Good. Thank you.
You want to say hi to your
mom?
Thank you.
Thank you.
And if you want to say a word, you can.
Thank you.
Just 1 minute. Oh, my name is Betsy McDonald, and I represent Children's Waiting Room Head Start. We're a Head Start program that serves families that need child care all day long, plus people who have business at court or have jury duty can drop their preschool age children off with us for as long as they need also. And I'm happy to accept this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And thank you for bringing the children.
My name is Karen Bohall, and I'm on the Cal Poly Committee this year for Children's Day in the Plaza. I'd like to invite all you guys out there on Saturday at the Mission Plaza. It's 10 till 3. It's just a day to kickstart the Month of the Child and just to celebrate the youth out there. So I hope you all make it.
Thank you very much. We will do our best. Okay, that concludes our presentation calendar, and with that, we will go to the public. I have unusually quite a few request to speak forms this morning, so I'll call one name, and Jesse Arnold can go to one podium, and then I'll call the next name, and the next person can go to the other one. So the first name is Jesse Arnold, the second one is F.K. Dawson.
Thank you, Chairman Bianchi and members of the board. I am Jesse Arnold. I live in Cambria. Excuse me. I'm here to speak on BT corn. I spoke on this before, but there's plenty to say about it. BT corn is the genetically engineered corn that has a gene for a bacterial toxin engineered. The toxin kills the worms that like to eat the corn. So this sounds like a perfect solution. The insecticide is in there 24 hours a day. It's in every cell of the plant. The farmer can sit back. He doesn't have to spray. Boy, you got it made. It's perfect. Well, let me point out that it's not quite that simple. Since it is an insecticide, not a repellent, it doesn't keep the worms away from the corn. They do have to come and eat enough of the corn to kill them. So you still could have some damage on your corn. So if you have consumers who are so picky that they don't want any damage, you haven't made them happy either, perhaps. But the long-term problem is that in any insect population, there's a genetic variation, and there's some in the population that are resistant to just about any insecticide you can think of. So the same is going to be true with BT. So if your crop is killing the worms throughout the season 24 hours a day, you're, of course, just killing the weak ones, and you do a real good job of that, and you've left the field open for the strong ones who are resistant to this particular pesticide. So it won't happen in 1 year, but eventually, if this is the way you approach your problem, you are going to develop resistance in the worms, and then your BT corn is no longer useful. So I would prefer to do things in a way that are sustainable and not short-sighted like this. Also, as I pointed out, I put forth a challenge to the proponents of this crop to show me a long-term study that was not supported by the industry showing that there's long-term safety for humans consuming this product or that there's long-term safety for the environment. So far, no one has stepped up to meet that challenge. No one has showed me such a study, so I'm still waiting for that. This also should be labeled. You have a letter from our Ag Commissioner saying that he's in favor of labeling. I think if you'll poll the public, you'll find most of the public is in favor of labeling. So I would like to see this board get behind the effort to tell our federal legislators. Unfortunately, that's where the power lies. But we can all, and your board, can tell the federal legislators that we want labeling of genetically engineered crops. Thank you very much.
Thank you. For those who haven't been here before, you've noticed there's some lights there. And the first 2 minutes, the light is green. The second, third minute, the light is yellow. And then when the light is red, your time is up. So, and I will remind you if you didn't notice. Okay. So with that, Mr. Dawson, followed by Mark Phillips.
My name is F.K. Dawson. I live at Wood Drive in Cambria, and I'm here to comment concerning the Cambria traffic signal at Main Street and Pine Knolls Drive intersection. I apologize for not commenting earlier. I think it would have been easier for all of us, but if I had done so, I'm sure for me. On March 24th of this year at the Cambria Community Service District meeting, Dave Flynn, your transportation manager, stated that the signal has been installed based on the circulation plan. He did not say it was justified by a traffic control signal need study of the current traffic conditions. On April 1st, 2005, a few days ago, over the phone, he told me that a project-specific study concerning a traffic signal was done in 2002 in conjunction with the circulation plan. At my request, he said that a copy of that project-specific study would be available to me tomorrow afternoon, April 6th. It seems that your prudent action or inaction needs to be based on your risk manager's private advice to your board. If she advises you that the county would be best able to defend itself against a lawsuit using the now available 2002 project need study, the board need not take any action in this matter, in my viewpoint. Such a lawsuit filed due to an injury or fatality accident at the intersection with or without the traffic signal being in operation, unfortunately, is a possibility. However, if your risk manager advises you that the county would be best able to defend itself against such a lawsuit using a current traffic control signal need study, TCSNS, prepared in accordance with the State of California, MUTCD 2003, California Supplement, May 2204, Part 4, Highway Traffic Signals, the prudent action by the board would be desirable, in my viewpoint. The first action would be to direct your Public Works Department to not operate the signal at this time. The second action would be to authorize and direct that a TCSN study immediately be performed in accordance with the Manual of Uniform Traffic Control Devices, MUTCD.
Mr. Dawson, your time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mark Phillips, followed by Eric Greeney.
Good morning. My name is Mark Phillips. I reside in Atascadero. Representative Dennis Kucinich will soon introduce the Genetically Engineered Food Right to Know Act of 2005 for the 109th Congress. My intention in speaking to you today is to let you know that I plan to introduce a resolution that I hope you will look on favorably that would request our representatives to support this bill and to become co-sponsors of this bill. The bill states in part that the process of genetically engineering food results in the material change of such foods, that Congress has previously required that all foods bear labels that reveal material facts to consumers, that federal agencies have failed to uphold congressional intent by allowing genetically engineered foods to be marked, sold, and otherwise used without labeling that reveals material facts to the public. Consumers wish to know whether the food they purchase and consume contains or is produced with a genetically engineered material for a variety of reasons, including the potential transfer of allergens into food and other health risks, concerns about potential environmental risks associated with genetic engineering of crops, and religiously and ethically based dietary restrictions. Consumers have a right to know whether the food they purchase contains or was produced with genetically engineered material. Labels voluntarily placed on foods are insufficient to provide consumers with adequate information on whether or not all the food they are purchasing contains or was produced with genetically engineered material. Mandatory labeling provides a critical scientific method necessary for the continual post-market surveillance to study long-term health impacts and enforcement of food safety laws preventing adulterated foods from reaching consumers. Many of the United States' key trading partners, including countries in the European Union, Japan, and the People's Republic of China, have established or are in the process of implementing mandatory labeling requirements for genetically engineered food. Adoption and implementation of mandatory labeling requirements for genetically engineered foods produced in the United States would facilitate international trade by allowing American farmers and companies to export and appropriately market their products, both genetically engineered and non-genetically engineered, to foreign customers. It's shocking that the FDA considers genetically engineered foods substantially equivalent to non-genetically engineered foods. Genetically engineered crops contain antibiotic resistance marker genes, viral promoters, and foreign proteins never before consumed by humans. These are not found in crops produced through normal means of hybridization. Further, the FDA is not testing these products itself. The agency is relying on edited summaries provided by the very companies that have a financial interest in bringing these biotech crops to market. And under the current FDA law, the companies are not even required to produce summaries. There's been several polls for people asking if they want labeling, and here's one in July of 15th. 92% wanted labeling. It's hard to get 92% of the people to agree what day of the week it is. That's pretty amazing consensus on that. So if anybody would like to provide comments or have any questions about the resolution that we're going to be trying to put together, they can contact me through slogefree.org or at my phone number, 461-0376.
Thank you. Your time
and
is up.
I'd like to give a copy of
the Eric Greening, followed by Teresa Campbell.
Thank you. I am Eric Greening, a member of the 92%, and I am very strongly in support of the issues being raised by the people talking about GE corn. I do have another topic this morning. Before I get to it, is that a heart or an automobile? Because if it's a heart, it's upside down. It is an automobile. Okay, thank you. Now that I get a closer look at it. Oh, all right. All right. Well, it's...
Check your glasses, Eric.
It's done with real heart.
Yes, it is.
My main topic is that I found last Tuesday's meeting extremely informative. I doubt that many people did because it was not covered by KCBX or AGP video. It was not in your usual location, not well publicized, and on a fifth Tuesday when people assume you don't meet. It was open to the public, but where was the public? How were they supposed to find out about it? Why wasn't AGP invited to videotape? This is the second time this year that you've met in retreat format. The first one at the Inn at Morro Bay, I declined to attend because it was called a team-building event, and I anticipated feel-good psychobabble instead of discussion of issues of substance. I later found out I was wrong, but how was I to know? The Inn at Morro Bay, by the way, is extremely hard to reach for non-drivers. Anyway, I don't recall past boards indulging in this quasi-retreat format when discussing important county business. This is a new trend you're starting. Why? The budget information presented to you last Tuesday was of compelling interest to the public, and the discussions among yourselves likewise. While it is true that no final or binding decisions were made, when such decisions do come before you, the public would be far better informed in addressing you about these decisions if it had been privy to what transpired last week. There is plenty of time on today's agenda for you to have scheduled the discussions you in fact had last week for today and had them carried to the public by KCBX and AGP. Please go no farther in the direction you've been heading. When you're not in closed session, you are in open session, and that openness should include full use of the wonderful resources KCBX and AGP provide to keep the public informed. If you think you need retreats, what are you retreating from? Thank you.
Thank you for your comments, Eric. Teresa Campbell, followed by Mike Salina.
Hello, my name is Teresa Campbell, and I'm from Cambria, and I'm here today to inform the board and the public of a possible health risk and environmental risk to our county, actually nationwide. And this involves the latest genetically engineered accident that has occurred and has been occurring in our country since 2001. A little background, in 1996, the Swiss chemical company Syngenta received approval from our regulatory agencies to use the BT gene that Jesse was talking about. BT is a pesticide to genetically engineer this what's called BT11 was the approved gene into what is primarily in our country corn. Apparently, at the same time BT11 was tested, of course, other traits were tested also, and from 2001, there was a gene called BT10 that was very similar to BT11, but was not approved and not tested by the regulatory agencies, but apparently got mixed up with the BT11, and since the year 2000, the BT10 gene has been genetically engineered into corn that Americans have been growing and eating also. It turns out about 185,000 tons of this corn has been grown. Nobody knows quite for sure where the corn was grown, who grew it, how much of it has gotten into our food supply, but on the 21st of March, it was revealed to the public that this accident had occurred. I guess our government found out last year at some point. At first, it was stated that that there was no worry for human health or the environment because BT10 is exactly like BT11. We didn't feel too reassured by this because a few days later, it did come out that the BT10 gene is different. It has the antibiotic resistant marker ampicillin in it. The reason that they put antibiotic marker genes into genetically engineered crops is not that they want that in there, but it's a way that they can test to see if the somewhat random process of getting the gene into it's not a natural process to see if it really took. They put antibiotic resistant genes in it, and then they douse all the plants with antibiotics. The plants that live are the ones that took the trait that they want. But antibiotic resistance isn't necessarily something that we want to be consuming in our food. So what they do now is when a GE crop is approved, they breed that out. Well, the BT10 that was accidentally put into our food still had the antibiotic resistant gene in it. So it is not identical. This shows how our regulatory systems are not working because we rely on the chemical companies to do the testing for the products that they make. This wasn't caught by our regulatory agencies, so this went on for 4 years. And so the question is...
And your time is up.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Teresa. Mike Salina, followed by L.J. Hansen.
Hello, my name is Mike Salina. I'm from Cambria. Thank you for letting me speak today. We'd like to suggest a couple of actions that the Board of Supervisors can possibly take, and again, we've included these in our letter. And we did speak to the Agricultural Commissioner yesterday, as well as the Jackie Crabb from the Farm Bureau as well, to let her know what some of our suggestions were. The biggest thing that we'd like to have happen is that the board or the agricultural commissioner would notify farmers that this has happened, because this has received no press, literally. The Tribune has not done a story on it, even though we've tried to get them interested in the idea. And nationally, it's only been covered by a couple of papers. There's been one AP story that's been out. And so that's the biggest thing, is that the farmers be informed of this happening so they get an understanding of how these accidents occur and how other GE crops might affect them down the road, even if they're not intending to plant them. Another recommendation is that the Ag Commissioner formally recommend that farmers maybe not plant Syngenta corn for a year or two. Again, we're not asking for a ban on the technology itself. There's other BT corns out there that are not Syngenta that don't have this problem. We're especially worried because it turns out that Cal Poly did a study last year and they used Syngenta's BT11 corn in that study. And so there is a chance that they may have grown this unapproved variety and sold it to the public. And from our standpoint, since there are other options of genetically engineered crops available, there's no sense in not suggesting that farmers maybe not plant this. We also think that the Ag Commissioner may want to inform local farmers markets, because they have an ag database that farmers register with to let them know that they're growing corn or grapes or other produce, but not all farmers do that, especially if they're growing a lot of different crops on their farm. And most of them sell at farmers markets, so it'd be good to notify them. And then some of these others are things that the Board of Supervisors can do, including asking the EPA and FDA to provide evidence that these things are safe. In the press releases we've seen, they keep saying that the FDA says it's safe, but there's been no documentation available on the FDA site. I've called the FDA. They have no formal documentation that says that that BT10 has been shown safe. And another action would be to support the Genetically Engineered Food Right to Know Act, which Mark talked about earlier. And then finally, there's a bill that was just introduced in the state Senate, or the state assembly, excuse me, that would protect farmers from genetically engineered crops, genetic pollution from those crops. And that's something, it's AB 984, that the board may be interested in supporting. And basically that would just protect, let's say, an organic farmer from, if there was contamination of their crop, they could sue the chemical company instead of suing his neighbor, which is their only option right now. So thank you very much.
Thank you for your time. L.J. Hansen, followed by Marianne Buckmeyer.
Yes, my name is Chairwoman Bianchi and fellow board members. My name is L.J. Hansen, rural Arroyo Grande. Calendar Garrett, as some of you might remember, is the victim of poor planning, and it is getting worse. Years ago, a large area was rezoned industrial. The neighbors were horrified, and most of it was rezoned back to RS. An exception was a 10-acre pocket in our residential community on Winter Haven. This was promised to again be rezoned to RS with the cleanup of the South County update in the early 90s. Here we are a decade later. The parcel came before the Planning Commission in 2000. They felt that we were stuck with the industrial zoning and put a large number of planning standards on the 10-acre area as a whole before giving approval to a subdivision of 4 1-acre parcels and a remainder of 5.88. And a year later, Public Works removed an important road safety issue since it would be too costly for the developer. Putting a price tag on safety is pretty sad. We were promised many things, including buildings residential in appearance and no further lot splits. We were led to believe this meant structures that would blend in with our one-story ranch-style homes, which are about 2,000 square feet in size, and lots of camp-style landscaping on all lots. The community has tried very hard to live with the results of this project, but at each turn, something new turns up that further hurts our way of life. Lot 1, they have erected a huge half-acre metal structure, no articulation, and certainly not residential in appearance. Plus, the owners are operating a fiberglass spa business there, hardly something that fits next to homes and children. The remainder of the 5.88 acres wants to further subdivide into 4 parcels with many buildings. This has not as yet been accepted by the county and should not be accepted. Lot 2 wants to erect two huge two-story barns and divide the ownership into three. This is coming before the Subdivision Review Board May the 2nd. We all know that if the Planning Department recommends approval, we are looking at a rubber stamp. The only recourse then is to pay the $400 and to appeal to the Board of Supervisors. Plus, if they are allowed to further subdivide, a precedent will be set, and the rest of the unbuilt lots will do the same. This injustice to our community seems to be never-ending. Please do not allow any further concessions on this property. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Mary Ann Buckmeyer, followed by Rick Arricchio.
LJ swiped my glasses and then didn't even use them. Mary Ann Buckmeyer, Rural Rio Grande. I'm here on behalf of the Napomo Community Advisory Council and the Traffic and Circulation Committee as the traffic chair. I've been the traffic chair for 6 years now. I was here about 60 days ago, and I'm here again, and it's the same topic. Nothing's changed. You are our benefactors, and I really need to stress that you are our benefactors until we become incorporated down there. And I want to make sure that you've come down to see what has been created. I know that three of you have been to Napomo in the past 6 months. I don't know that you've been down at Taft and 101 or Mesa and Highway 1 and Halcyon at peak hour times. And I invite you to do that now. The level of service at each of these locations is way below what is required of C or above, and it is E and F during peak hour times. These are 25-minute delays on Taft, and now you're hearing me for the first time talk about 20-minute delays at Halcyon and Highway 1. I am telling people who call me to get a book on tape or to learn Russian, maybe Japanese, because there's nothing they can do. They just sit, and they are getting angry. Page 3 in the Traffic and Circulation Study, Exhibit A, E equals speeds that are reduced to low. Driver's ability to maneuver becomes extremely difficult with high degree of frustration. Level F means conditions are forced to break down where flow is concerned. The driver is stopped for long periods due to congestion. That's as low as that the county has in terms of ratings. Please remember the big picture as you continue to get more requests for general plan amendments. If you haven't been to our community to sit in peak hour traffic, you cannot even imagine how the county's planning has gridlocked us everywhere. There's only one way in and one way out for the people on the Mesa and in Napomo. The big picture was supposed to have been the cumulative EIR reviewed by the Morrill Group, which was an outcrop of the Save the Mesa lawsuit against the county in year 2000 regarding growth management. This EIR review, as of 2005, has yet to come up for any reading. This review was to be an overview of all the general plan amendments, so we could see the impact of all the GPAs. I don't know what else we can do to bring our reality to you except to invite you to our town, and I will pay for your lunch. I'll cook for you. There are daily episodes of road rage and driving up over sidewalks and through parking lots. A median will soon be put in front of Vons and Longs because the accident ratio there is in the ionosphere. Just imagine the delays then. And Dale Ramey says we can do this traffic bit at night, but, you know. Again, this doesn't include the four new shopping centers you've approved and the new developments going in. It's irresponsible to continue to approve.
Ms. Buckmeyer, your time is up. Thank you. Rick Arricchio.
Ms. Bianchi, Board of Supervisors, good morning. My name is Rick Arricchio, Pembroke Drive in Cambria. I've come to speak about the proposed traffic signal in Cambria on Main Street and Pine Knolls. On March 30th, I borrowed a copy of the Mid-State Bank EIR from the County Planning Department, and I read its traffic study. The study was based on the standard method of counting cars, measuring delay times, and using statistics for customers going to a bank. The nature of such a study, of course, results in estimates and predictions. I don't intend to dispute the process of doing a traffic study nor its conclusions. I intend instead to point out incorrect assumptions and elements not considered by the study. When we start with the wrong numbers, we'll have the wrong answer, no matter how good our math is. First, the study is based on a 7,000-square-foot bank, when in fact the actual bank is about 5,800 square feet. There's a 1,200-square-foot community room that is not used for banking purposes. It's used outside of business hours, so it doesn't add car trips. The study, however, missed this critical distinction. They went wrong from the start, and they therefore assumed too many car trips. The result was an exaggerated traffic prediction. They estimated about 192 cars per hour to the bank, and double that in peak hours. For a typical banking day, that's about one-third of the town going to Mid-State Bank every day. That equates to every man, woman, and child in Cambria driving through that parking lot twice a week. It's quite a challenge, even if it were possible to do so. Second, there's a three-way stop sign at Cambria Drive that was not present at the time of the study, so its effect was never considered. For more than 2 years now, this stop sign has effectively spread out the traffic on Main Street, and that has changed the delay times that were used in the study, and thus their predictions are now wrong. But all of this is elementary. We don't have to rely on those estimates, the predictions, no matter how wild they may seem. The Mid-State project was completed over a year ago, and there's been no traffic signal at Pine Knolls in all that time. Traffic continues to flow smoothly, the predicted delays are not there, and the forecast congestion simply doesn't exist. We do create an EIR to trust its predictions, because it's all we have until the process is finished, until the project is completed. Only then do we see the actual impact. What we have here is something wonderful. We have much lower traffic impact than was predicted, without making any additional unnecessary changes to the environment. After all, the EIR talked about environmental and aesthetic considerations for the bank project, didn't mention the traffic light at all. We therefore urge the board to authorize a new traffic study, one that measures the real world. Tell them to come to Cambria to measure our bank trips, to time our turns, to count our cars. This new study will support our position that a traffic signal is not warranted and that it should be removed. We all value highly our quality of life here on the Central Coast. It's something we cherish because we all put forth the effort and the leadership necessary to maintain that quality as we grow and change. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. That was my last request to speak form. Is there anyone else who wishes to address the board? With that, I will close it to the public, and I would like to make two comments. One is relative to our goal-setting session. The public had the same opportunity to find out where our goal-setting session was and the times and the location and all the rest of it in precisely the same manner that Eric found out about it. And everyone was welcome to come. We've had many other goal-setting sessions. Well, many. We've had three since I've been on the board. Prior to the last two. So there's been a total of five altogether. We're not going in any direction that we haven't gone before. And my second comment, and also it was an excellent day. It helps if, I think in any organization, if you don't make a decision, it helps just to get together and schmooze. And basically that's what we did with some form. We had an agenda, but you know, it really does help. And relative to the traffic light in Cambria, I'm going to make a motion, because we can do this after public comment. We can't make a decision on a traffic light today, but I would like to make a motion. In fact, I'm going to make a motion to put this on a future agenda for a discussion. There are at least three departments involved in reopening this discussion, and so it would need to be a coordinated presentation from Public Works, Planning, and Risk Management. So with that, I will make a motion to put the traffic light in Cambria on a future agenda for discussion and possible action.
I'll second it.
Question about the motion. Does it need a motion? We just tell them, bring it, put it on the agenda. Yeah. You're the chair, you can put it on the agenda.
I think it needs a motion, doesn't it, Vicki? Yeah. No?
It doesn't need a motion unless we hear three of you objecting to it. We can just...
Yeah.
Okay, we'll just put it...
Put it on the agenda.
We'll put it on the agenda for on a future agenda for discussion and possible action.
Pardon? So you're withdrawing your motion?
Yeah, I'll withdraw the motion then. I thought it needed a motion.
Just make a direction.
Okay.
There, you put it on the agenda.
With that, you will be notified when it is on the agenda. Okay. With that, I will close it to public comment. And the next item is a presentation by Public Health that I'm really looking forward to.
First Five Commission.
Oh, excuse me. It's First Five Commission. The presentation, the First Five San Luis Obispo County Children and Families Commission 2004 Community Report.
Well, thank you. My name is Susan Hughes.
You have to talk right into that mic.
Pull it closer.
I get too close.
No, you have to almost swallow that.
Almost swallow it. Is that better?
Susan, you might want to be pushed it out of your side. You can see Mr. Lenholt if you're not able.
I actually can see, but I have to kind of see both. Good morning. My name is Susan Hughes. I am the executive director for First Five San Luis Obispo County, and I am here to share with you information from our 2004 community report. I want to tell you a little bit about who we are, where we've been, and where we're going. As many of you know, Proposition 10 was created in November of 1998, and it increased a tax on tobacco by 50 cents on each pack of cigarettes. Initially, we thought about $2.5 million would come into the county, and it did, but over the last few years, that figure is now around $2 million. We knew from the beginning that money from Prop 10 would be, as cigarette smoking decreased, then our money would go down. So we've been planning for that. 20% of all the monies go to the State Commission, and they do various things with their monies. 80% go of the funds go to county commissions, and it also established 58 local commissions throughout the state. And these commissions are the folks who oversee the local programs. So First Five California is the state commission. It's made up of 9 members. As I said before, it funds statewide efforts like our kit for new parents. The kits here in our county are distributed through OBGYN offices and pediatric offices and to child care providers. We try to get to the moms before they have the baby so they have time to learn about all the good things that are in those kits. The state commission also provides matching funds to designated initiatives that they have determined to be important, such as school readiness and the Children's Health Initiative. And Rob Reiner is the chair of the First Five California. You see him there reading to children, which is one of his favorite activities. Locally, our First Five Commission has 9 members. 5 members are actually designated by the law, but early on, the Board of Supervisors had the foresight to increase that membership to 9. There you see Don Dennison in the back row, who represents the Children's Services Network, Lee Collins, who represents Department of Social Services, Dr. Renee Bravo, who represents our Medical Society, Dr. Julian Crocker, who represents the County Office of Education, our chair, Kacho Kajian, our co-chair, our vice chair, Biz Steinberg, who in this arena, she wears the Child Care Planning Council hat. Joel Derringer is one of our community members at large. Dr. Greg Thomas represents our public health department, and Kathy Long is our second community member at large. And Commissioner Derringer and Commissioner Long really actually make an application to become members of the commission, which is then approved by the commission and ultimately goes to the board for your approval. I think we're one of the few counties actually in the state who have those types of membership. Early on, the State Commission said we'd like you to look at funding 3 focus areas: child care and early education, parent education and support, and health and well-being for kids. Now, that obviously covers a lot of ground and is a broad brush on where they thought we should put our funding. So we did that, and I'm just going to take you quickly through. I have a lot of information this morning, so bear with me. I'm going pretty fast. In 2001 and through 4, under child care and early education, a couple of the programs that we funded were state preschools. We actually increased 5 state preschool sites. We increased the day from 3 hours to 8 hours. And at 3 Head Start sites, we actually were able to provide year-round services. And you can imagine, if you're a working parent, like was said earlier, if you can get full-day good child care for your kids, you're going to be more productive at work, and they're going to be more productive in what they learn. So we thought that was a very good place to put some funding. Under parent education, we funded a first-time mothers program and a teen academic parenting program, which is we call TAP. Each program has worked with about 190 moms over the last 3 years. First-time mothers actually works with moms, new moms, for up to from 2 to 2.5 years, so they really stay with the family. Both programs provide parent support and child assessment. In health and well-being, we actually did a vision screening project with the Lions Club. That program has assessed about 3,000 kids each year in preschool for vision disorders and delays. I don't know if you can remember, I see a lot of you don't have glasses, but I do, and I got them at an early age. And I remember looking at the board, and I couldn't see it, and I didn't know what was wrong. So that was pretty scary for a youngster. But this way, we're getting those vision disorders at an early age, and by the time they then get into kindergarten, then they're ready to go. We actually found out that 10.5% of the first 12,000 kids that were assessed had some type of vision disorder that could impair future learning, so we're able to get that fixed before they get to kindergarten. Our Baby's First Breath program is tobacco cessation services to pregnant moms and also does education on secondhand smoke to parents of kids 0 to 5 and to child care providers. If they are smoking, we try and get them to take it outside, and then hopefully eventually we might get them into cessation services. So our funding in our focus areas, the three focus areas, kind of looks like this. We did about a little over $6.6 million over the 3 years, and 40% of that in health and well-being, 46% in child care and early ed, and parent ed at about 14%. And then how many numbers did we serve? What we did here is we just did a quick average of children on an annual basis, and we figured that in child care and early education, we touched about 458 children and child care providers. Parent ed, we saw around 3,100 families, and in child health and well-being, we touched around 6,000 children and families. Some of these numbers are duplicative. We also did two rounds of mini grants between 01 and 04. Again, they did address the three focus areas. We got about over 60 applications for funding. We were able to fund 44 programs at the amount on the screen. We bought playground equipment. We bought some equipment for the Clínica de Tolosa. We did a raise awareness program on postpartum depression. And one of the fun ones we did, I thought, were we funded 9 small family child care providers at $1,000 each, and then they gave us what they wanted. They figured out what educational materials they wanted. They submitted it to First Five staff, and we got with a vendor and got the vendor to give them all a discount, so they got some more materials than they originally thought. So, and they were delighted, those 9 child care providers. Now, this 2003 to 04 expenditure graph is our audited. It's per our audit. We are audited by an outside auditor on an annual basis, and you can see that we spent 77% of our money on our direct service programs, those ones I just took you through. We had a 12% cost in administration. Our school readiness initiative that is now old, but it was new then. That money was being spent on planning and implementation. And we did have a child care retention initiative that's been with us now. We're in its fifth year. That was 4%, but that number actually doesn't include the $106,000 of stipends that were distributed to 114 providers in August of 04. So that program really was a larger program than what seems to be on the screen. So what are we doing now? In 2004, 03-04, we did a lengthy strategic plan review. After much discussion, the commissioners thought, well, we need to go deep, not wide. We need to really go deep with our funding in order to make impact. They chose and identified 4 targeted initiatives. They looked at the direct service programs they had been funding and found 11 direct service programs that could support those initiatives. And then they did decide to eliminate mini grants. They also said programs that focus on education and prevention are much more cost effective, and we want to fund those types of programs. Additionally, they want to, one of our goals is to achieve system integration with programs. We know that if programs work together and they can share resources, they're more cost effective, they're more sustainable, and also if they collaborate, they can also garner and leverage and stretch funding further. So those are the other things that we try to work with our current funded programs on. So a little bit about each initiative. Our school readiness initiative is really our largest initiative. There are two locations, at Georgia Brown Elementary in Paso Robles and at Oceano Elementary in Oceano. Before we did this, either one of these programs, we did a comprehensive needs assessment because the commission felt strongly that each community needed to tell us what it was they needed and wanted. We actually got 4 to 6 focus groups together. Each focus group had child care providers or educators, health care providers, we even got community and leaders and city officials together from Paso and Oceano. Then, after finding out, determining what it was each community needed and wanted, we convened what we call neighborhood teams from members of that focus group, and they actually continue with us today in the planning and implementation of our initiatives. As far as I can tell, I've been asking around the state, we're the only program in the state that has this continued community input. Each school per year gets $238,000. Paso Robles is eligible for state matching funds, so half of that money comes from the state matching funds. So it's a 4-year project equaling about $1.4 million. The commission also, though, did enhance those programs and added another about $600,000, not to each one of them, but divided about in between the two to enable the program to do more of their utopia goals on what they wanted to achieve. This was one of our very our fun days. We had our first 5 school readiness center grand opening, and that school readiness center houses a state preschool, a first 5 preschool, an Even Start program, and also has some room in the afternoon for parent education classes and anything else that could be used by the community. And here you see a banner being, it's our ribbon, being cut by one of our neighborhood team parents, and Cacho's there helping, of course, but we had a great day that day. And again, more pictures from that. I think the children had fun, and I think one of the fun things, observations about this slide is that those young boys couldn't take their eyes off the mariachis, and we stood back as staff and said, whoa, what role models. What a great role model. Another initiative is our Child Care Retention Initiative, or Project Reward. This is really our longest-lasting initiative. We're in our 5th year now. The state announced that they will continue matching funds to 2009. It is a stipend program for child care providers to increase the quality of child care. We quite honestly have had some challenges in the model that we've been using, and the state recognizes that. So right now we're reassessing that model for the next 3 years, and staff's working with Project Reward staff to bring a new proposal to the commission in May. Third initiative is our Children's Health Initiative. Many of you are aware of this one. It started with 100 members of the community going to a luncheon and coming out with 100% support to ensure every child in San Luis Obispo County. So over the last couple of years, First 5 supported the implementation and planning process. There is now a new 501c3 that is actually going to implement and carry on with the program. First 5 funding continues to support the infrastructure and when applicable, we'll support the zero. Or when we get to the subsidy area, the time frame for that, we have provided 0 to 5 subsidies. And we expect enrollment to begin in May with coverage to begin in July. So it's coming right upon us. I think quicker than the new executive director would like, actually. Our fourth initiative is our Perinatal Substance Abuse Initiative. Beginnings, again, a lot of you have been involved in this. It actually started with a very small $15,000 mini-grant to send a leadership team to Chicago. You see the members who attended. It's a really broad-based group of folks who attended. They came back so excited to get they hit the road running and started almost without us, but we caught up and said, we want to be a part of this, and we expanded that into one of our initiatives. Dr. Chasnoff just visited with us last week, and unfortunately we have concerning statistics to share. Out of the 1,305 women initially screened last year, We find that in Slo County, 35% use alcohol before they know they're pregnant in the months before, compared to only 22% nationwide. And a more alarming, 22% in Slo County continue to use, where only 11% nationwide continue to use. And we seem to see our young moms are heavier drinkers, that 14% drink 3 to 7 times per week versus 9%. So this initiative is timely. We need to do it. The group that's involved in it is very excited, and they're moving right along, and I know that First Five is right there with them. Now, I mentioned the funded programs that we fund. In addition to the four initiatives, all our direct service programs must support our initiatives in some way. You remember I talked about the Head Start program earlier and how they were doing some in-home visitation and parent ed. Well, after having been in that mode for about 3 years and knowing that school readiness was coming, we've remodeled that program a bit. I think everyone here can remember their first day of school. I know I can. I didn't have kindergarten, and I didn't go to preschool. Fortunately, I had a nice, nurturing mom and dad, and they helped me through it. But that first day was absolutely terrifying. I remember about the only thing I remember is Mrs. Sollers rhymes with dollars. That's how I remembered my teacher's name. But I had no idea how to sit, where to go, you know, any of those things. Well, Head Start now is providing a 3-week transition to kindergarten program. Why didn't we think of this before? I know it's been going along, but it's been going along, I think, in Head Start for a while, but not everyone knew about it. And First Five has begun to support more of that type of program so that when the kids get to kindergarten, it's not such an unusual environment that it scares them to death. It's a friendly and nourishing environment for them. Also, the TAP program is another place where we've done some remodeling. Because of the Perinatal Outreach Initiative, we realized that teen moms are 2 times more likely to abuse alcohol and drugs, and so that program has shifted to help its focus to help support the Perinatal Outreach Initiative. Another program we're pretty proud of is Raising a Reader. That supports our school readiness initiative. It's now open in the Library Study Center in Paso Robles and will be a part of the new Oceano Library at both school readiness sites there. The Community Foundation, San Luis Obispo County Community Foundation, pledged $50,000 of funds to support that program. It's basically these kids and parents come and get books, bags full of books, and then they go home and read them. And it's been well received up in Paso Robles, and we're excited to see it start in Oceano. I just heard on the news today that there's a survey that just came out that if the more TV 4-year-olds read, the more likely they are to be bullies. The more they're read to, the less likely they are to be bullies. So I couldn't help but think about Raising a Reader. Another program we fund and have funded from the beginning is Healthy Kids Now. This is a tape that's put in each kit for new parents in our community, and it's an overview of what Prop 10 programs do. In addition, there is a monthly update that goes into more detail about each program, and that can be seen on cable channel 2 and the COE channel 19. And actually, this program is going to be highlighted at our state conference in April as a unique and innovative program, and it's very cost-effective. As I said before, one of the things the commission decided to do was focus on prevention. We know that studies show that for every $1 invested in early childhood education and preschool, you can save up to $7 to $10 in increased, or there's a $7 to $10 return, excuse me, in increased earnings and reduced welfare assistance. For every dollar invested in immunizations, will save you $10 in future hospitalization and treatments. And every $1 invested in smoking cessation can save you up to $21 by reducing the effects of low birth rates. So this in itself leverage, focusing on prevention in itself helps leverage Prop 10 funds in our community. Some of the programs I want to share with you, though, that because this is the month of the child, that do address reduction of child abuse is our CSIP program, our First Time Mothers program, Head Start, and our Teen Academic Parenting program. Those public health nurses and family advocates and social workers actually respond to situations where children could be at risk for abuse and neglect, and as a result, they get to them before there is abuse. Additionally, we fund a postpartum depression program that prevents a situation to turning from a non-emergency to an emergency situation. So we feel like we're doing pretty well in addressing that child abuse issue in the form of a prevention strategy in our county. So I've talked a lot about the commission, the programs we fund. I'll tell you just quickly about staffing. We actually, the commission has an MOU with the county to provide professional staffing services for the county. We have a 3.5 full-time member staff. When we were doing our strategic planning, we discovered that counties that are comparable to us, those that get about the same amount of allocation and fund about the same amount of programs, had 5 staff members. We knew we were understaffed, so the commission authorized an additional staff member, and we added an administrative services officer within the last 6 months. So we have a person that can really focus on program quality and one on finance. We also, though, we do fund or contract out for our evaluation needs, and whenever we bring together community, if we need a facilitator, we contract out with them. What are we doing as staff currently? These are some of our goals. We are just about to launch a procedure for program site visits. We're going to go out and visit programs and look at their programs on site, and also look at their financial records. We did one site visit to all of our programs in the first 4 years, but we realize we need to do more of that. We're also going to bring to the commission a policy on administrative expenses. Our state association has been working closely with the Government Finance Officers Association. Because each county commission is unique, and that's how it was meant to be, everybody seems to define administrative expense differently. So what the GFOA is having us do and trying to do for us is to get some uniform definition of admin expense. And then as soon as we get that, then we're going to bring a policy to the commission to make sure that they establish a cap on admin expenses so we don't spend more than we should on that. We want to put as much money in the program as we can. We have, as I said, Prop 10 funds are going to go down. We have sought additional fundings. Last year we had $128,000 in grants, and we have been looking hard at how to leverage federal fundings like MA and targeted case management fundings with Prop 10 dollars. And then lastly, despite how greater programs we have funded over the years, there's still a lot of people who don't know us. So we're trying to get out in the community more, like this presentation, go to more Rotary clubs, more Kiwanis clubs, more faith-based organizations to let everybody know what the good work our programs are doing. For 04-05, I thought I'd share with you, this is our commission investments, a little over $3 million, again, 12% to admin budgets, about 30% direct service, 28% school readiness, 20% child care retention, 9% the Children's Health Initiative, and a little bitty 1% for the Perinatal Outreach Initiative, but they're making big strides in the community with just that little bit of an investment. So I've been here telling you about all the great work we do. Well, why are these programs important? Well, did you know that at birth, a child's brain has about 100 billion unconnected brain cells? To me, that's just overwhelming. And that an infant's brain adds 250,000 connections every minute. You know, I vision it like little roadways being connected by little bridges so little cars can go over them. And when those bridges aren't connected, the cars fall off. I mean, we always thought they just laid there and Googled and, you know, they didn't do anything. But, in fact, they were percolating and we didn't know it. Some of those connections will become permanent. The others will disappear. And it really depends on what's used. If they're used, they become permanent. If the kids are nourished, if they're taught, if they're held, if they're provided education, if they're healthy, we know that they're going to do better in years later. And I think this particular sentence sums it up for me. Children are 1/3 of our population and all of our future. So just as Cacho said, eventually when those 5 little children from Head Start are sitting in your chairs, that we're all going to be more grateful that they went to Head Start, and they're going to be more productive adults in our community. We just redid our First 5 website. I invite you to go up there. We refreshed it, and it has all of our minutes, agendas, and everything you want to know about First 5, and a link to the State Commission. and to our School Readiness Initiative folks. So invite you to learn more about us. If you haven't, I know each of you got a report. Please feel free to call us if you have any questions. And I have lots of reports for the audience in case they'd like any. And I've probably exceeded my time. I apologize for that, but we had a lot to say. Thank you again for your time.
Okay, don't go away. I have one light on. Actually, now I have two. Kacho?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to publicly thank Susan for the great job she has done for the first five commission. Look forward to be working with you in the future. And also want to thank two of our commissioners, Vice Chair Ms. Steinberg, who is with us here in the audience, and Dr. Thomas, who's always an asset in our community at large. I want to thank all of you for the great job you have done in our community, especially for our children. Thank you.
Mr. Patterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I, too, just wanted to thank Susan and the staff and the commission for the fine work they're doing. I truly believe that education and prevention are key to a successful future for all of us, and I think the work that you're all doing is not only essential, but it is turning things around for us in the future, and I thank you all.
Mr. Ovett.
Just going to bring up my my pet peeve, I guess, is to make sure that these types of funding and organizations get out to the smaller communities in this county. And the reason I bring that up is just recently we saw that almost every school in the county is its size is reducing because of the makeup of the communities, with the exception of a school like Sam McGill. And what we're seeing is many of these people are moving to smaller communities because they can afford to live. And I know from the past that we've seen statistical analysis used from these usually small communities to support larger communities, and yet the services have not gotten out there. And that's just kind of my pet peeve that I've witnessed, I've worked it, and it's just something that I want to make sure that in your outreach and that you're doing is that you are getting out to those areas. And yeah. That's really what I have to say. Other than that, great.
Okay, and finally, I was on the team that was funded to go to Chicago, and that program is absolutely vital in this community, and I would like to thank the First Five Commission for the opportunity, one, to go to Chicago. As a native Californian, I can't even say the word. And for all of the help in getting the program started, because we need it desperately in this county. And that's to keep every, to start out with, to stop pregnant women from drinking alcohol or using any other illegal or sometimes legal substances. And then we're also putting together the program to treat the children whose mothers did use alcohol. We have to think. The first program for the perinatal substance abuse is called Beginnings. I don't know what we'll call the second program. We haven't come up with a name for that one yet. But these little guys need all the help that they can get to integrate their brain functions, because their brain function is disrupted. And if there's too much perinatal substance abuse, the brain function is disrupted. Tragically. So, thank you very much. There were no requests to speak forms on. Oh, Eric?
Thank you. I am Eric Greening, and I also would like to thank you for a wonderful report and for all the good work the First Five Commission is doing. And just following up on the issue of perinatal substance abuse, I would point out that. Those who are in utero are also harmed by substance abuse that is not the choice of the mother. Things such as pesticide drift and other toxic substance to which one is involuntarily exposed. And I would hope we would be as vigilant in protecting people from involuntary exposures to toxic substances as from voluntary exposures. Thank you.
A good point, Eric. Thank you. Biz?
Well, I think, Biz Steinberg, First Five Commission, one more thank you, I think.
and it's just for the ages of children beyond five, because you all, as the Board of Supervisors, I want to thank you for funding towards the Children's Health Initiative, because, you know, even though the focus here is zero to prenatal to five, your funding is helping us make sure that children 6 to 18 who don't qualify for Healthy Families or Medi-Cal will also have health insurance. So I just wanted to add that word of thanks to all of you.
Well, thank you very much. It's always nice to get a thank you. So thank you for your presentation. With that, we will move on to the consent agenda. Eric, you will...
Thank you. I am Eric Greening, and I just have a question on B9. Actually, I think I know the answer, but I want to be sure it's clear on the record, because it makes the description here makes the parks and recreation element sound like a new project, and the use of unanticipated revenue to a casual onlooker would make it sound as if there is some change in the cost or scope of the project. And my understanding is this is a fully anticipated project whose scope and cost are not changing, but new revenues are being found to complete it. But I would hope that could be clarified and perhaps a little bit said about its progress and how the citizens can help participate and move it along at this point. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. I have no other request to speak forms from the public on the consent agenda. Harry, do you have any?
No, ma'am, sir.
Jim?
No, ma'am.
Jerry?
No, ma'am.
None, thank you.
No, I was... B9, I was going to ask Pete to respond, and then we'll move to approve.
Pete Jenny, Parks Manager. Eric is correct. There is essentially, this is not found money, unanticipated revenues for the uninitiated. It's kind of government speak for money that just has not yet been appropriated in the budget. The project is moving apace. This is really an administrative move, consolidating the various funding sources and also migrating to our delightful new financial accounting system that we're all struggling with mightily. The project is moving at pace. In fact, this evening at 6:30 at the Vets Hall in San Luis Obispo, the County Parks Commission will once again be taking up the review of the element. And for those who haven't heard, this is an update of our 1968 Parks and Recreation element. We felt it was about time to bring it into the 21st century. And we're now going through that public review process with the commission. The community is welcome to come and provide input, either in person or in writing. And hopefully we will have a review draft before the Park Commission, then the Planning Commission, and to your board by year's end.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have a motion to...
Second.
Then we have a second. We have a roll call, please.
Mr. Ovid? Mr. Shajian?
Aye.
Mr. Linthal?
Aye.
Mr. Patterson?
Aye.
Mrs. Bianchi?
Yes. That concludes our... concludes our morning hearing and the day's hearing, but now we have to go into closed session. So I have no request to speak forms on closed session, and approximately how long will that last?
20 minutes. It's always 20 minutes.
Well... Ms. Shelby would like to know how long she has to stick around here.
22 minutes.
Okay. With that, we will go into closed session, and sometime this morning we'll report back out. Thank you. Yes, we've returned from closed session. May we have a report out, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The board met in closed session this morning for 19 minutes, considered the items that were listed on the agenda, and took no final action, which means that no public report is required, and that's the public report. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much. With that concludes our day's agenda, and we are adjourned.